Where did your entrepreneurial journey start?
Both of my parents had very entrepreneurial spirit, so I basically have it in my blood. I started my entrepreneurial journey when I was in college, and I had a brand called Cut Clothing, a small clothing store which I started on Etsy. And that basically started because I didn't like how college t-shirts looked on my body. I had a 10-year career in the auction world. The thing that people think about the auction industry is that it's all glitz and diamonds, when in reality, auction houses are running on pennies at a time. When it comes to manufacturing, the development process is more expensive than you think. Because of the sampling, if you want to do it right, my brand isn't throwing a logo on a t-shirt. I could have done that 5 times by now and had whatever quality and whatever. But quality and performance fabrics and the look and the style were really important. So, like, there's a reason why I'm doing this. There's a reason why I quit my job and have been doing this full time. It's because I want to create women's golf apparel that has performance fabrics, that is ready for the golf course, but that is transitional into the real world, if you will, too. You see all these beautiful glitz and glam and this car and whatever. There's so much crying that happens behind the scene. There's so much money lost, pivots you have to make, and the emotional toll that goes into it alone.
How do you go about it? What keeps you going, right? Everyone has a different mission, vision. Some people want to be rich and they're on a path and they figured out, like, hey, this is my path, which is perfectly fine. But you got to be mature enough to realize that, hey, that is your path and this is why you're in it. Welcome to Funds and Founders. This weekly show is tailored for Austin founders navigating the early stages of their entrepreneurial journey. I'm your host and fellow Austinite, Abhinav Sinha. If you're looking for the motivation and the insight needed to build a successful company, you're in the right place. Today we have Daniela. She's new to Austin. She's a golfer, has had various marketing roles in her career, past owner and designer of cutclothing.com, and is currently the founder of Aya Golf, which is a lifestyle brand for women golfers. Welcome to the show. Would you like to give listeners a quick intro about your background?
That was a great intro. I can't believe you know about Cut Clothing. It's a really deep dive. I'm new to Austin, just 1 year old here in Austin, loving it so far. I have a women's golf apparel brand, like you mentioned. It's called Aya Golf. Before that, I was doing 10 years in the auction world in New York, which was really exciting. So I'm on a whole new journey and I'm loving it so far.
I like to ask every guest, where did your entrepreneurial journey start? So if you were to pick a moment in time or some past event, what would you say that irked inside you to be an entrepreneur?
I grew up in an entrepreneurial household. Both of my parents had very entrepreneurial spirit. So I basically have it in my blood. Both of my parents worked on Wall Street. They were in the commodities business and built it from the ground up. So I saw that while I was growing up. But besides this business that I have now, I started my entrepreneurial journey when I was in college, actually. And as you mentioned, I had a brand called Cut Clothing, a small clothing store, which I started on Etsy. And that basically started because I didn't like how college t-shirts looked on my body. And I wanted to make it look more flattering and feminine. So I would take college t-shirts and cut them up in my dorm room and wear them to football games. And people would comment and they would say, where did you get that t-shirt? And I said, I literally cut this up in my dorm room bed 10 minutes ago. And it turned into a small business.
Nice.
Yeah. So that was my first business.
What was that journey like? How do you decide to start an Etsy store? What does it mean? How do you get customers? How are you getting supply? How are you doing distribution? How did that journey start?
I was working also full time. At that time, I had actually been working for Rolling Stone magazine. This was very much a side hustle for me and just kind of figuring it out. And the crux of the business was to take men's vintage t-shirts from the 80s and cut off the top, cut off the neckline and also the bottom and create more of like a crop top off the shoulder look, which the women really liked and I really liked. So sourcing fabrics from usually California, I would buy just t-shirts in bulk from California, cut them up myself and figure out how to put them on an Etsy store. And that's basically what all that was.
Nice.
Yeah.
And were you running it part-time for the 5 years or at any point were you full-time doing?
I was never full-time doing that. That was always a side business and Instagram was my only marketing and I would reach out to influencers and give them t-shirts and just most of my sales were from Instagram, which was great, which Instagram was new at the time. This was back in 2012. So
they're pushing it quite a bit as well.
They were pushing it. They liked the different style.
Nice. Yeah. In terms of building a company, did you see Cut Clothing as a company, or was it always a side project, or did you ever run it as a business and try to figure out the nuances of running an apparel business?
At that time, no. It was very much a side thing for me and just kind of figuring it out. I always had this fashion bug inside of me as well. In college, I had entered into quite a few fashion shows where I would create pieces from plastic bags and tissue paper and things like that. So I had this design bug in me that I wanted to express. And so Cut Clothing for me was just literally figuring it out, if I could do it, how to run the back side of it, the back end, what an Etsy store is, accounting, things like that. But it kind of fell off as I went into my long-term career at the time, which was in the auction industry.
Yeah. Why the auction industry? And if I remember correctly, it was primarily in the watch space, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
So I had a 10-year career in the auction world, and that started basically when I left college. I always had an interest in the arts and business, kind of both of them together. I actually went to college with the intention of going into international art law. So doing things with Nazi-looted art, et cetera. I found out very quickly that law school was not for me, so I did not go down that path and instead dabbled in a few different things. Like I mentioned, I worked at Rolling Stone magazine. I still had that art bug in me, so I left ad sales, essentially, and I went back to a summer program at school, to Sotheby's Institute of Art, and that's where I learned about the auction industry.
Okay.
And I found out what art business was, and I really liked the business side of the art world instead of, say, working at a museum or working at a gallery. The auction world was very fast-paced, cyclical, basically unregulated still to this day. And most prices for pieces were because of two guys in a room who wanted to show how much money they made. So it was really interesting to see how things developed over time and how prices grew, you know, over the years.
What's one key insight you have from that space that an outsider would be oblivious to?
It's a great question. I think the thing that people think about the auction industry is that it's all glitz and diamonds, when in reality, auction houses are running on pennies at a time. So most of the time when you see a $100 million painting being sold and it sells for $110 million, most of that money is going back to the seller. So the auction house has to first get that piece. They have to wine and dine the customer to actually get that piece into their auction, and there are different terms that can be agreed upon. A lot of times when it comes to big ticket items, auction houses are losing money, but they just want to say, oh, I sold this Rembrandt for X amount of dollars. So they'll basically do anything to get the piece and have the marketing proponent of it, but it's not all glitz and glam. It's really a tightly strung business, if you will, that most people don't realize.
Interesting.
Yeah.
How do you go from art to watches, and why go to watches?
So I started my auction career when I was living in Chicago. I lived there for 5 years after college. And again, I knew I wanted to be in the auction world, but you basically can't go to school for it. You just have to enter it and learn from the ground up.
Yeah.
So I started at the front desk as a receptionist, and eventually I was wearing many hats, as most people do in the auction world, or most businesses, but definitely in the auction world. So eventually I was cataloging different types of items. I was packing and shipping. I was learning about accounting. And I became what was called a generalist in the space. And a generalist basically means you could put a silver cup, an African sword, a rug, and a piece of jewelry in front of me, and I would be able to value all pieces. So a lot of research goes into being able to do that.
Yeah.
And that's basically all it was. I was researching quite a bit. Fast forward a few years, and I got more into cataloging jewelry. So I would know all the jewelry dealers in Chicago. I became friends with them. They would teach me things, how to figure out how to look at silver, gold, things like that. And soon enough, I was cataloging full jewelry catalogs. So after a number of years in Chicago in the auction world, you hit a ceiling. And if you want to kind of take your career to the next level in the auction space, you need to be either in New York or London.
Got it.
So I was born in New York, and I decided, why don't I go back to the homeland and try the auction world there?
Yeah.
So I quit my job in Chicago, picked up and moved to New York, lived on my girlfriend's couch for a few weeks and just like figured out where I was going to be and basically started from square one again in New York, because being a generalist in the auction world in New York basically means nothing. You need to either have a father who's paying tons of money for paintings or be hyper specialized in something like porcelain eggs.
Okay.
I was neither. So I started at the reception desk and worked my way up and found the vintage watch side of the auction world almost by mistake. There was an opening at this auction house. The position was called a viewing assistant, and it's basically a girl behind the counter taking watches out of a case for clients.
Yeah.
What was fascinating to me was that people were flying in from around the world to see these pieces of metal on your wrist. And the stories behind them were so intricate and so deep, and people were so into it. I immediately was into it. And it was so fascinating how much trust and time and effort that people built this community around the vintage watch world had. I was hooked. So I thought, I want to be a part of this world now. Worked my way up into the watches department and eventually did business development for watches in New York, which I loved. I actually loved what I was doing at the time.
What's a key memory from working in watches that still stands to date? Could be a piece, an interaction, whatever.
So in 2019, had the honor of selling Jack Nicklaus's watch, Rolex. I, as a golfer, knew who Jack Nicklaus was, and that was really exciting for me to have this famous golfer come in and entrust us with his watch to sell. And because I was the only one on the watches team at the time that really knew anything about golf or had any interest in it, frankly, I was kind of the key point person for that whole sale. So I took the watch around the world and showcased it to different professional golfers and different potential buyers, and was able to garner a good amount of attention for the watch. The watch ended up selling for about $1.2
million. Nice.
Yes.
Sometimes it's very hard to fathom that a piece of paper goes for 30, 40 million, a random watch that the common man has no idea what it is, but valued at 5, 6, whatever, like some absurd amount. And it's interesting to see how those prices get generated, how the market talks about these things. And there's a lot of history I think I just don't understand, but it's just, I've seen some random bits here and there, and it's interesting to see how people value these things.
It's all about storytelling.
Yeah.
You never sold the piece, you sold the story. There's a lot that goes behind telling a story in a catalog. Months and months of work of putting photos together, building basically a magazine for one piece to make sure it garners the attention and the price that you want or that the client wants. And there's a lot that goes into selling a piece of art.
You know, sometimes when people do collectibles, they're like, oh, this is worth 20K, 30K, whatever. My counter to that is always, it's only worth that much if a buyer is willing to buy it. And that could change overnight. My understanding is you could buy a piece of art today, but tomorrow, no one values it. No one's going to buy it for 20, 30 million that you bought it for, because for whatever reason, it's lost its value.
That's 100% correct. It really... Any piece at auction, it garners that price because of two people in the room that want that piece.
Yeah.
And there are so many reasons why someone buys a watch or a piece of artwork. It could be because you truly desire that piece. You love the history. You want that in your collection. The great thing about the watch world is that most of the collectors are true collectors. They've been doing this for a long time. We had a lot of European and Asian clients that had a true appreciation for the watch world and the history behind it. But a lot of times, especially on the fine art side of things, especially contemporary art, it really is a show of how big your wallet is sometimes. And that's all it takes. Two people in a room trying to outbid each other that will dictate the price of that artist for the next 30 years.
I was in a random Uber in Los Angeles once, and the cab driver was like, oh, look at these billionaires trying to get their name on a building. Because after a point, that's the next big thing you can put your name on, and you just do it to show someone else that.
Yeah.
And I was like, a very interesting take. Like, I never thought about it that way, but when you say it, I'm like, oh, that probably is true at some level.
Definitely.
That people are just playing, I own like 7 buildings. It's an interesting
popularity
take.
Contest a little bit.
In your journey, how do you go from a watch expert to some extent to, hey, I'm going to move across the US, start my own brand? How did that journey start? What was the catalyst for doing that?
So I've been golfing for over 20 years now. I played competitively when I was younger and just socially as an adult. I could have played in college and decided not to, so it's been in my blood for quite some time. It was one of those things that I grew up playing with my family, so I have the family connection, and my dad would be my caddy, if you will, at all my tournaments in high school, and it was a family thing for us.
Yeah.
I loved the auction world. I was in it for 10 years. I thought that was going to be my career for the next 20 years. I really enjoyed it. I was at a point in my career where I was in the middle of a lot of office politics, frankly.
Yeah.
And I tried to continue. It turned out to just be too emotionally draining.
Yeah.
And I felt like I needed to get out. I was turned off by the industry, was turned off by a lot of things, and I needed a break. This was in July of 2021. I knew I was going to leave the auction world at that point. I didn't quite know what I was going to do. I was out on a trip with my mom and my brother. We were in Colorado. My mom and I decided we might go golfing. So we went to this pro shop, this clubhouse in Telluride where we were. And we decided not to golf, but we were in the pro shop. And I wanted to buy something cool that said Telluride on it to take back with me when I went back to New York. So the same thing I've been dealing with over and over for years and years is when I go to the women's section of a golf pro shop, it's the same fits, the same fabrics, the same ugly patterns. Half the things are on sale because no one wants to buy them. And there's a very small selection. So of course I didn't find anything that I liked. And I was like, okay, let me just go look at the kids section just to look. So I found this little girl's shirt. It was very small. And it was a tie-dye pattern with mesh sleeves and a mock neck collar. And I held up this top and I was like, if this was in my size, I would buy multiples of these. I love this top so much. It looked cool and edgy. Yeah. And it had some kind of something different to it that most golf pieces don't. At that point, it was every time I tell the story, I say the same thing because it's true. I actually blacked out. I had this moment where everything in my life aligned at that moment. I knew I was going to leave New York. I knew I was going to leave the auction world. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had this entrepreneurial bug in me. I didn't know how that was going to play out. I think of myself as relatively fashionable, and I've wanted to explore that for some time. Maybe I put all these things together, plus my love of golf and just I've been ingrained in the golf world for so long. Why don't I create clothing that I would actually want to buy? So it hit me like a ton of bricks. Even the name of my brand came to me in that moment. It was the craziest thing I've ever experienced. I've never experienced anything like it since. And I left that moment and I was like, oh my gosh, maybe I should start a women's golf apparel brand and see what happens. So I took the next 6 months to really think about it and just see if this was for me. And December 2021, I fully quit my job in the auction world. And I've been doing this full time ever since.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it was all like easy charted out path. You start in Jan 22.
Yeah.
And everything aligns.
Absolutely. I had this idea in my mind and everything went the way I wanted it to.
You had some experience running an Etsy store, so I'm assuming you had some idea of running an apparel brand. But when you decided to get started, what were your first couple of steps? Was it incorporation? Was it validation? Was it supply? Like, how do you go about that? How do you decide what to do?
The Etsy store, yes, gave me a little bit of experience, but it was like a drop in a bucket that is the size of an ocean. I mean, it is nothing compared to everything I experienced this past 2 years. The first thing I did was enroll myself in basically how to build a fashion brand 101 course. And I did a 6-month online course of how do I get a logo? How do I source fabrics? What do I need an accountant for? What do I need a lawyer for? What should I look out for? How do I get a manufacturer? Where do I source a zipper? Things like that. That was a great way for me to dive in and realize the other steps I needed to do in order to really build this out to be a successful business. And when I went into building Aya, I felt so aligned with my vision even from the beginning that I never thought of it as a small business. Yes, it's a small business, but I never thought of it as, oh, I'm just going to put this on Etsy and like try to build an Etsy store. Nothing wrong with Etsy. But in my head, this was going to be a real business, something that I wanted to do for the next 10, 20 years. So how do I really make that sustainable and build it correctly from the ground up? So I took a lot of time to speak with people and to make sure I had the right people around me. Again, whether that means accountants, lawyers, people that could guide me when it comes to business and just put future investment, things like that. I've made about 4 million mistakes since then. I mean, first is listening to people on Instagram and social media who tell you, you can put $5,000 and in 6 weeks have like this thriving business. It is such BS. And I hear that so many times from people around me. My friends are like, oh, I'm going to start this bra business or I'm going to do this business. And they're like, but I only need $10,000. I always say no. And again, I've only been doing this 2 years, but I feel like I could write books about this now.
Yeah.
Whatever you think you're going to spend in time, emotional capacity, and money, times it by four. Like whatever you think you're going to do, just throw it out the window and just let the reins take you. Have a general plan, but you're going to have to pivot like you've never pivoted before. And your ego is going to be checked multiple times. And any insecurity you've ever had, it's going to come up over and over and over again. And you're just going to have to face it and pick yourself up every single day if this is really what you want to do. And I've dealt with that every single day since I started this.
What keeps you going? What keeps you driven to build this company up? Because I'm really, irrespective of the pitfalls, something's keeping you going. Like, I got to figure this out. I got to do this. I got to do that.
You know, I have tons of stress building this business. And, you know, it's money's coming out of my pocket and I'm learning everything from the ground up. But despite all of that, I feel so grounded and aligned in what I'm doing. It just was a feeling. Like there's a feeling that I'm doing something right. I found my calling. And I don't know how else to explain it except it's a feeling. It's a gut feeling of like, yes, it's hard, but this is exactly what you're meant to do. That's literally what keeps me going every day.
I like it. So you do the course. You're now empowered with Business 101 and Fashion 101 knowledge. What do you do next? How do you go about building a brand?
So at that time, I enrolled in this course in January. So it was June, July, by the time I ended of 2022. In my head, I wanted to launch my first line by November of that year, which if anyone knows anything about retail and manufacturing, people laughed in my face when I said that. And I was like, okay, this is a big lesson. Manufacturing takes forever. The whole development process takes forever. It costs a lot of money and it just takes a long time, especially since I was the designer and I didn't have the technical skills. Like I'm not creating my own tech packs. I'm not measuring the seams and things like that. I needed to hire out. So you're not
giving the specs the manufacturer needs.
No.
You're giving them looks and design, but
exactly.
Like not the size.
Right. So I tried to go to manufacturers directly myself to try to do it myself. They either laughed at me, didn't respond, or told me I needed a minimum quantity order of about 10,000 pieces, which is not what I'm trying to do right now, especially bootstrapping this business. So again, I tried to align myself with people that I knew could help me and guide me. And I started outsourcing some of the work, especially for tech packs. And I hired a company based out of New York that acted as a middleman between me and the manufacturer, because frankly, I didn't know what I was doing. So I wanted to produce low quantities, 100 of each piece. I didn't want to spend tons and tons of money on that. And I wanted certain fabrics because fabrics are really important for what I'm doing. And I needed all of those things to come together. So someone had to lasso exactly what I needed.
Yeah.
And I was able to find that, but it took a lot of time and a lot of money to do that.
So you started in June or July. How many prototypes or samples did you go through before finalizing your first manufacturer?
I think I got 4 samples. And it's not like, oh, every few weeks you get a sample. It's like, oh, every couple months you get a sample. So, you know, and then there's things like Chinese New Year, if you're manufacturing abroad. Holidays here in the US that you have to take into account. So the process just gets extended, but it's usually about a 4 sample process.
Okay. And how long did it take you to go from, I'm going to start this to I want my first line out? When did that go out?
So I just launched my first line 2 weeks ago.
That was a photo shoot. Okay.
Yeah. So it's been 2 years. Now, that's because I started from the ground up. Most that, you know, no sustainable business can wait 2 years for another line to come out. But I hit as many roadblocks as you can imagine. And I wanted my sampling to be correct. I wanted the product that I put out to be exactly what I wanted so that I made sure that we took the time to ensure that. But yeah, it took me 2 years to fully launch the line and make sure I had all the photography and the marketing ready and figure that side out.
Nice.
Yeah.
And so now this is live.
Now it's live.
Nice.
Finally, the boat is rowing. It's really exciting.
What were some of the biggest learnings here, right? So one was the time expectation of how long it takes for stuff to happen in this space. What are some other key learnings you had in this journey of getting samples, specs, outsourcing, manufacturing?
For the manufacturing process itself, there are also minimum quantities for fabrics, which I didn't know. I just thought, oh, I can make 100 dresses and these factories will give me whatever fabric I need. No, they want to sell you rolls and rolls of fabric, which I understand. Me, I'm like a drop in a bucket. They have people like Nike they're working with. They can't even look at me. So I get it. Yeah, when it comes to manufacturing, the development process is more expensive than you think because of the sampling, if you want to do it right. And again, my brand isn't throwing a logo on a t-shirt. I could have done that 5 times by now and had whatever quality and whatever.
Yeah.
But quality and performance fabrics and the look and the style were really important. So, like, there's a reason why I'm doing this. There's a reason why I quit my job and have been doing this full time. It's because I want to create women's golf apparel that has performance fabrics, that is ready for the golf course, but that is transitional into the real world, if you will, too. Yeah. Golf wear that doesn't look golfy, that looks more like high-end athleisure, but it's still structured enough to be cool, to look good on the streets of New York or wherever.
You're going through this journey, you're building, you're getting samples. What are some other business things you're doing that are helping the company move along, the website, this marketing? There's a lot of like other tangents, because building the line is, I want to say, just one piece of running an apparel company, right? How do you think about all those pillars? How much time are you spending on just the samples versus everything else? And how are you going about that?
Yeah. So right now I'm a one woman show. I mean, everything is falling on my lap. I'm dealing with accounting right now. And that's something I have to go into QuickBooks and do myself. And I have people that help me with that now. But, you know, I've had to learn how to outsource when needed. And I've been through multiple tiers of people who basically I entrusted and took advantage of me, took money from me, said they could do X, Y, and Z and did not do that or did not have the qualifications to do it. So I've learned a lot from that as well, making sure that I'm getting recommendations of people that I'm working with, things like that. For example, I have a social media company that I work with that has been helping me with my social media for some time now. That doing social media is a job within itself. There 100%. Is no way I could have done that. There's no way. So I feel very fortunate that I have them on my side, and I've been working with them for almost 2 years now, and they really know my vision. They know me, they follow me. So aligning myself with the right people that really want to help the brand grow is essential. Yeah.
How do you go about getting those referrals and recommendations? Because I think when people are starting out, it's like, oh, let me go Google and figure out how to do X, Y, Z. But how did you go about that? Because you said some people took advantage, some didn't.
Mm-hmm.
How do you vet that? What do you do to vet that? And what's some advice you have for people trying to vet different aspects, agencies, vendors, whatever?
That's a difficult one to quote vet. For example, I have two sides of the business I'm building. I have the physical garments, which is like the crux of my business. And on the side, I also have the digital side of my business. So I have an NFT project that I built, but I'm also integrating chips into my clothing or NFCs, which will come out later this year. That was really important to what I'm doing. I have an interest in the space and I wanted to make sure that that was molded within my company in some capacity. So when it came to the digital side of my business, I met a lot of these people that I work with now at conventions or conferences. I love conferences. I'm a big conference person. I'm the person that's in the front taking notes. I love it. So, and networking at these are really important.
Yeah.
So just building your network that way. I met someone at a conference over a year ago, a year and a half ago now. I gave him the general idea of what I was doing and what I wanted to do and the trajectory. And he said, oh, I can help you build out the digital garments for what you're trying to do. And I said, okay, that sounds really good. You know, he seemed to really know what he was doing and talk about. And we worked together for quite some time. And I was paying him a monthly fee. It was like a consultancy, but he was delivering assets to me. And this was just a learning, massive learning curve on my end. But he was not vetted by anyone that I know. I just, I had a gut feeling for him at the time, and we hit it off, and we seemed to have a good working relationship. My mistake, and I would not recommend that anyone do this ever, and this is a mistake I will never make again. We never had really had an agreement in writing. Everything was word of mouth, and I know better, but I was like, you know what? I trust him. I trust this. Let's see what happens. Shame on me, because when I asked for the assets to be delivered, gone. He was gone, took my money, wasn't answering my phone calls, my messages, anything like emails. After a year of working together, this isn't a random person I just met. This is a year of working together. And I hear from him, you know, a week later, and he's basically extorting me for money. So asking for more money in order to get the assets, which I already paid him for. And it was a whole big thing. It cost me a lot in legal fees, emotional wherewithal. Everything about it was like to my core, shook me. That was a mistake that you just have to make sometimes. Like, I wish there is this magic guidebook of great people that could help you and have great intentions for you and mine. But sometimes you just have to throw yourself off a mountain and 100%. Hope for the best. And, you know, you're not always going to hit the good ones. Sometimes you just need to learn.
I had a guest on a couple episodes ago, Mark Nathan. He's big in the Austin space. We were talking about finding the right mentors and how do you do that, right? And the difficult thing about doing that nowadays is a lot of mentors are out there trying to sell their service, right? They're like, oh, I'll mentor you. But like, you know, if you really want the good stuff, like it's like $3,000 a month or whatever, right? And so we were talking about how do you go about finding the right mentor who aligns with you on values and can help you grow, because this is not supposed to be a monetary thing.
Right.
And I think there's so many nuances there where even when finding a vendor, finding a service provider, right? On one side, yes, there is the service and like, okay, does it make sense? Are you going to deliver? But on the other side, how do you make sure they're aligned with what your outcome is? Because service agencies and vendors are very incentivized to bill you and to just do the bare minimum versus how many of them are sitting with you to understand your true outcome and be like, you know, let's not do this because, you know, you want to achieve XYZ. This feels like a better plan to do XYZ. And when working with folks in the past, sometimes I'll drag on a proposal conversation for 6 months, but until I feel the, oh, you're aligned with what I want to do. Well, how much you're charging is irrelevant, right? But if you're aligned with what I want to do, it's easier for me to trust and say, okay, let's go and set up this relationship.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting to see how different people make those decisions, make those relationships, because when you're bootstrapped, every dollar counts a lot more. And so you can't just sign 20K, 30K contracts left and right. And if it doesn't work out, it still hurts you, right? But interesting take there.
I feel like another big lesson for me, and this has caused me some strife in the past, because I had never in my life received so much unsolicited advice. And I'm in a spot where I want advice. I want mentorship. I'm open to it. And I'm looking for people. I want to learn from people. I do. I want to be in a room of people smarter than me. I really want that. However, I feel like the loudest people will always make it known how they feel about your business, 100%. How you should run your business, who you are, what you're doing right, mostly what you're doing wrong. And it's always those people that would never leave their 9-to-5 and they would never put their own money behind their business. Yeah. It's always those people that are the loudest. So I've had to learn to really filter the noise, and that's taken some time. That's not take it personally, number one, and filter the noise. And it's always the cool, quiet ones that are the most successful, and you can just feel it. You can feel it in your gut when they come up to you and they treat you like a human. And they're like, yeah, I was in that spot not that long ago. I understand what you're going through. If you need any help, let me know. And you could just feel that sense of camaraderie of like, yeah, it's not an easy thing that you're doing. Let me help you too.
Part of the reason I started this podcast was I want to talk with folks like you who are in the journey, like, hey, I want it out by November, but it took 2 years to get my first line out, right? And I think not enough people talk about that.
Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned social media. Oh, like, spend 5K, 10K, whatever. I feel like social media pushes this angle of, hey, you can start tomorrow. And, you know, you in a week, you'll have a million run rate. And, like, in 3 months, you can sell your company and retire. And, like, everyone pushes this agenda. And I feel like people start getting into it for the wrong reason. Because nowadays, starting being an entrepreneur is as easy as putting up a landing page and saying, I'm an entrepreneur, right?
Yeah.
And I think people get it wrong. And I think people are in it for the wrong reasons. And if someone comes to me and says, I want to be rich, I'm like, go work in tech and you will guaranteed be a millionaire in the next 10, 15 years. But running your own company is not what you should be doing.
100% correct. If you're in it strictly for the money, it's never going to succeed. I don't care how much sweat equity you put into it. If it's not part of your heart, it's just not going to fly. And so when I see those things on social media, it drives me absolutely nuts.
100%.
Because first of all, I also believed it partially, which I'm embarrassed to say. But you see all these beautiful glitz and glam and this car and whatever. But, you know, there's so much more behind it. There's so much crying that happens behind the scene. There's so much money lost and pivots you have to make and the emotional toll that goes into it alone. No one talks about how lonely it is. How lonely this
process is. Especially if you're a solo founder.
Oh my God. And how much people give you advice and they expect something back or they want X amount of equity or, you know, whatever. And just figuring it out and paddling that boat through these waves. And no one talks about that on social media.
Yeah. That's what I want to start highlighting, right? The whole idea is I just want to talk about the journey. How do you go about it? What keeps you going, right? Everyone has a different mission, vision. Some people want to be rich and they're on a path and they figured out like, hey, this is my path, which is perfectly fine. But you got to be mature enough to realize that, hey, that is your path.
Yeah.
And this is why you're in it, right? So many times you'll see podcasts with have titles saying 25-year-old sold his company for 100 million.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go and do the research, he only made a million.
Right.
From that 100 million sale.
Right.
And he spent 10 years building this company. Was it really worth it if you only got a million at the sale? But no one does that analysis. Like you just look at the 25-year-old doing this and like, oh, I can go do that. And like, that's not how this works, right?
Exactly.
I run my own agency, right? And I think in the past 3 years, I probably wanted to shut it down 100 different times.
Oh, yeah.
For whatever reason.
Yeah.
But something keeps it going, right? Something makes me want to keep running that. And maybe it will fail in the next, I don't know. But I know I'm not in it for making 20, 30, 40 million, right? There's objectives, there's incentives, but as long as I know why I'm doing it, I think I'm fine. If at any point I decide this is not the right thing for me, I should go shut it down and figure something else out. But it's just part of the process of you've got to make those mistakes. You got to figure out sales. You got to do everything.
Yeah.
And people just don't talk about it enough.
I was talking about this with a friend of mine the other day. And I said, I realize now why most startups fail within the first year. Yes, it could be about the money and whatever, but it's about the emotional toll. Like this process takes on you. It's not easy. And if you don't have it in your gut that this is part of you, this is really what you want to be doing, there's no way it can thrive. If it's about the money, it's not going to thrive.
100%. And so, 100%.
Yeah, so I agree with you.
What's one of the biggest realizations you've had after starting iGolf?
I think the biggest thing at this moment that I'm now reflecting on, now that I've finally launched Line, is to just always trust my gut. I feel like there were certain points over the past 2 years that I felt like I needed to sway a little bit to make sure that I was appealing to the masses and I was doing X, Y, and Z because this golf brand is doing X, Y, and Z and they're making this amount of money. So that means this is what I need to do. Every time I swayed from the path, my original vision, every single time I was blocked. Something happened. Something went wrong. I lost money. People didn't like it. Every single time. And when I launched my brand 2 weeks ago at PGA Trade Show, which is a really big deal, I went into that experience saying, you know what? I built this business. This business is part of me. I am going into PGA Show 100% myself. This brand is an embodiment of me. This is exactly what I want to do. This is my vision 100%. Take it or leave it. The response I had was fantastic. People loved my vision. They loved what I was doing. I trusted my gut and I put it out into the world, my vision into the world, exactly how I wanted it and how I originally envisioned it. And the reception I got was tremendous. And it was a reminder to me of if you just are yourself and you're really trusting your vision and what you're doing, there's something there. There's something that's going to continue to drive you and people will see that in you as well.
How was the tour for you? How was the launch?
It was incredible. It was better than I expected, if I'm being honest. It was, you know, I've been working 2 years up to this point. Everything's go, go, go. And it was go, go, go at the show as well. But I didn't know how people would respond. The look of my brand is very New York, black and white, kind of chic. I want to go into this high fashion look. And the golf world is filled with a lot of patterns and loud colors. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just a sea of the same. And my booth stuck out like a sore thumb, frankly. It was just very different. And that's what I wanted. I had a vision for my booth. I executed that exact vision. I was really happy with it. And I didn't know how people would respond. And I had two people, I remember, that came and were like, I don't know, like, whatever. The rest of the people loved what I was doing. I got multiple walkbacks. People really commented on the fabrics, which was another reminder that I really focus on the fabrics. And that's another crux of my business, to make sure I have high quality within that. And I was like, you know what? I'm glad I took the two years to really spend the time to source the fabrics that I wanted, to have the exact fit that I wanted, to really blend my vision and the physical garments together in a way that's going to, again, embody me as this brand. And people's response was really good. Nice. So it was very validating.
Were you selling anything at the show, or was it just a launch?
Yeah. I mean, my intention was to brand build and to just show. Yeah. I didn't know if I would sell anything. And I actually went there thinking that I wouldn't sell anything. I'm a new brand. There's a million other booths around me that people know of. I am a newbie. No one knows who I am. I ended up selling things. I ended up getting my first wholesale accounts, which is really exciting and a big deal. Especially after pumping out money for so long, it's like, okay, now someone is also loving my vision enough to...
Like signed and like finalized contracts, or like hot leads?
No, these are finalized. Sweet. Finalized, yes.
Congrats.
Yeah, thank you. So that's exciting.
I think people don't realize when you've been in it for 2 years and you have a debut show, whatever, and you get the result you wanted, I feel like there's a sigh of relief of like, okay, I was not wrong. I wasn't...
It's validating.
Yeah.
Sometimes you need a pat on the back to be like, yes, your idea is good.
Because I feel like, at least me personally, at some point you need some reward, some sense of reward in the
100%.
Journey. Or else it's very hard to just grind for 10 years. It's very hard to just grind for 10 years.
Totally.
And I feel like that's a really good show of like, you were doing the right, irrespective of the mistakes, right? That's part of the journey.
Right.
But you were on the right path, the right vision. You figured stuff out and you saw the reward for, you know, putting in the hard work, right? And
absolutely.
I think that's very important to have in the journey, because if you don't, every day that it doesn't work, like, just compound and become much harder, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's like a reset. It's like,
yeah,
okay, I can take a lot more rejection now because... You know, that one thing went well, but
absolutely.
I'm happy that went well for you.
Thank you. I am too.
For people who are not aware of what it takes to set up a booth at a conference, and how much preparation do you need? How far in advance do you need to prep for the booth? And was it just you at the show? Or did you have help, not have help? But I've been a part of a couple of booths of companies I worked at, and there were teams doing everything, but I can only imagine what that looks like as a one-man person.
That was a totally throw myself into the fire situation. I had no idea what goes into building a booth. And I had the smallest booth. I rented out the smallest space that they had. Still was 6 months of preparation. 6 months of preparation. You have to rent a carpet. You have to figure out where electrical goes and how many volts are needed. I'm talking to Orange County Convention Center, asking them how many volts I need. I'm like, I don't know. I have no idea how many volts I need. tell me what I need. I had a TV in my booth, so I had to get that mounted and shelves. And I ended up hiring an assistant that was there with me, thank God. But the build process was basically me. And I hired the people to help me build the booth. But there is so much prep work that goes into building a booth. I didn't realize how much physical labor goes into it, actually, that I feel like I didn't have enough time to do enough outreach that I needed to do beforehand, because I was physically building the booth.
Yeah.
So like, no one tells you these things. It looks all nice and pretty when there's a 100-person team behind you.
Yeah.
When you're by yourself, even with two people, it's a lot. It's a lot of work.
When I was at Indeed.com, we used to go to conferences across, right? I went to one, I think I went to Grace Hopper in Florida, big booths. And I was just asking the people who run the shows from Indeed, like, what's the process? So they have a whole booth designer who designs their vision for 5x5, 10x10, 20x20, 40x40. And it's all the same thing, just different configurations. And then someone makes that.
Yeah.
But there's two versions of it because maybe you're doing shows back to back and you got to ship one there and then ship one there.
Right.
And then there's a team local at the convention center because they have a bunch of contractors that are authorized. So you got to find a team that works.
Yeah.
And then they come and build it. But someone has to make sure it reaches there. That's a different logistics team.
Yeah.
This is not counting all the merch we give away, which the people flying have to take with them. And then they're trying to get rid of all of it because you don't want to take any of it back.
Exactly.
And then there's like so many nuances of, like, I just showed up and volunteered. But like when I was trying to understand,
must,
like,
be nice.
Yeah. I was like, oh, there's a whole like industry behind this. And then when you're at the booth, your goal is to get badge scans because you want to like track. And
right.
So if you don't have a process for that, you're losing leads who are, and so like the 40, 30, whatever amount you spend, you gotta also have that on point. And then I'm like, that's too much.
I had to tape out my apartment floor with the size of my booth because I had to also do something in Canva. I basically made my own booth in Canva. Thank God I have an ounce of creativity in me. And these people understood what I was trying to do, but I had to make a mock-up of my booth myself. And I'm like, again, no one tells you that you're going to be taping your apartment floor to see where things fit. But there's a lot that goes into it.
Would you do another show?
100%. I feel like...
I'm guessing you're going to be more prepared this time around.
Yes. You got to do it once. It was... I cried a lot. You know, one of those experiences.
Where the show was in Florida?
Yeah, it was in Orlando.
Okay, nice.
It was in Orlando, yeah.
What was your key takeaway from launching your brand out of the show?
Kind of similar to what I was saying before, is to just go into it 100% yourself. I've never been super salesy, and I've seen people around me be really salesy, and I thought, oh, maybe that's what I need to do to get X amount of dollars or whatever. At the bottom of it, the relationships that I'm building are so much more important than getting 500 badge scans, and the relationships I made at PGA show were tremendous. And I wouldn't, every dollar spent was worth the relationships that I made.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that something you'd recommend to people starting out their apparel brands? Would you recommend shows, or do you recommend they wait, or just based off of your context of?
I was fortunate enough that I was able to financially do that. It's very expensive to do. I did it ahead of time, so I got some discounts and blah, blah, blah. But for me, this was a really important step for building my brand.
Yeah.
And now that I've done it, I'm glad that I did it. Because there's, again, I'm also my own marketing team.
Yeah.
So there's only so much I could do waving my Aya golf flag around Austin to say, hey, look at me. I need some actual sales, and I need people from in the golf industry and from around the world to see what I'm doing, see the vision in real life, see the colors, see me. So being there with a booth helped me tremendously.
Nice.
Yeah.
I like asking every guest this, but what are three resources and recommendations you have for people early in their journey building? And this could be a book, it could be a podcast, it could be a blog, whatever. Are there three recommendations you have for people? And this could be specific to retail apparel if you want to, or just in general business building, starting a journey?
I, again, have always been one to go to conferences and network. I built a great network just from living in a number of cities. And what I actually tell people now when they ask me, you know, how do you have this network of people? I actually like to go to networking events that don't have anything to do with the industry that I'm in.
100%.
I meet a lot of people who have a lot of different interests. Someone always has a connection to something.
100%.
I met someone, for example, when I first moved to New York, he's doing some cloud service. But before, he was a video producer. We met at a networking event when I first moved to New York. We had nothing to do with each other, but we hit it off. We stayed friends for years and years. When I left the auction world to do my own thing, he was one of the first people that was like, hey, I knew you had it in you. I'm excited you're going on this journey. By the way, I know this VC down in Florida who's interested in potentially funding a women-owned golf business. So that set me into different other organizations and just networking. I would say 100% network outside of your industry for sure, but be genuine about it. Don't be, again, salesy. Just be yourself. Everyone has a story. No one is only their job.
100%.
Everyone has some like weird guitar thing they do, or they like astronomy or whatever. Just be yourself.
Yes.
My second thing would be, and this was always challenging for me, but I've really leaned into this the past couple years, how important it is to balance your day. So, you know, everyone always says, oh, you leave your 9 to 5 to work 90 hours a week for yourself. Like, that is very true. And you feel guilty. There's this guilt that comes with not working sometimes, or like sleeping.
Why am I wasting time?
Right, yeah, like eating or anything. You're like, oh my God, I have to be whatever. I have dove pretty heavy into meditation. I would highly recommend Insight Timer app. Okay. It's a guided meditation app. It has basically saved me this past year, and just balancing those, the feelings of the insecurities that come up, or the imposter syndrome that comes up, or the overwhelm that comes up. Anything that you do that makes you ground is very important. I also feel like people don't talk about that enough, especially on this entrepreneurial journey. And the third recommendation I would say is definitely take advice from people, but learn how to filter it. Trust your gut when you're listening to people's quote advice. Again, I find that a lot of people are projecting on me, and I'm sure you get the same thing. They're projecting their own what ifs. What if I left my job 20 years ago to start my own thing? Or, well, you shouldn't be doing this. You should have this career or whatever. They're projecting onto you. So their insecurities come onto you. And don't let those insecurities turn into your insecurities. Yeah. Those would be my big three.
Nice. I like those. What would you say is your startup stack? So I like asking everyone what their current startup tech stack is. Notion, Jira, Evernote, like whatever, Google Drive. Different people have different ways they run and operate their business. Is there something that's worked well for you and you have a stack, so to say?
Yeah, I mean, I would say my stack is pretty small, if I'm being honest. QuickBooks has been a lifesaver. I thought about doing my books myself, and that would have been a disaster. I'm glad I didn't spend the money on an accountant. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Klaviyo for email marketing. Yeah. That's what I use.
They recently IPO'd.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah, I think like $1 or $2 billion valuation.
Oh, yeah. I understand why. And then I use MilaNote as well.
Okay.
MilaNote has been really good because I'm a visual person. So I like to see what I'm doing and my vision for the future. It's easier for me to use on MilaNote.
Have you tried Amiro?
No.
It's tech oriented, but if you like note taking plus like vision boarding plus like drawing and Venn diagrams and post-its and like, it's basically like a virtual whiteboard. And
you can do whatever. Amiro?
M-I-R-O.
Oh, M-I-R-O. Oh, okay. Yeah.
And you can do whatever on it. It's pretty cool tool. Okay. Used heavily amongst like tech folks to do planning and vision boarding and like, hey, here's what like I want this flowchart to look like.
Okay.
Pretty cool tool. If you have, I mean.
Interesting.
If you ever want to check out an alternative.
Okay, cool.
I ask all my guests for a question for a future guest. Luckily, your guest just passed by you, but his question is, what is one thing that you are not doing that you should be doing? And what is one thing that you are doing that you shouldn't be doing?
That's a great question. One thing that I'm doing that I shouldn't be doing, I'm working on it, but comparing myself and my brand and my growth, I know everything is all flash on the outside, but deep down, there's a lot going on behind the scenes, and I have to constantly check myself to say, it may look all fancy and glossy, but everyone's going through the same startup pains that I am. So to really be step by step with my process and not try to force myself to go faster than I need to. Yeah. And then what I'm not doing that I should be doing.
Yeah.
This is also something I'm working on. I feel like I'm not asking for enough help. I am notoriously need to do everything myself and feel like I need to take everything on myself, and it's caused quite a bit of burnout. And I've also had experiences, like I mentioned to you, where I've been taken advantage of in the workplace that has caused some PTSD, if you will, for asking for help. But I need to ask
by default for... now you just will not trust anyone.
That's the thing. That's the thing. And so I'm trying to be better about not generalizing that and just asking for what I need. And if the answer is no, the answer is no. It's nothing personal, but to just be honest about my needs and how I need to, you know, to be sustainable for myself and the company.
So what's one question you'd have for some future guests? I don't know who it will be, but.
Oh my gosh, this is hard.
Take your time.
This is for someone who has a co-founder. I do not have a co-founder, and I have, yes, I own 100% of the company, but I've also experienced my struggles with that. How do you find a co-founder? What is your experience building a business with a co-founder? And would you recommend that entrepreneurs have a co-founder before they start this process?
I have some answers to that if you
want. Oh, yeah.
My context will be very like tech and SaaS focused.
Yeah.
But I've heard people, I was just in SF for like a 1 week long program, which basically was to help people find co-founders' ideas, right?
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is people find co-founders for two reasons. One is you need a complementary skill, right? Mm-hmm. Product and sales, or tech and product and sales. Like, depends on how you structure that relationship. But that's one reason people find co-founders. Another is I met a lot of folks who are just building and they want to do it with someone because they know it's a lonely journey. Yeah. And they're not as strict about what the person knows or not, what they bring to the table. It's more, I just want someone who vibes with me on what we're building.
Interesting.
So I can build together, right? I've heard both these two trains of thoughts. Another interesting stat is 9 out of 10 startups fail, tech startups fail, and probably 7 or 8 of them is because of co-founder conflict. Because
mm-hmm.
people get into a relationship with their best friend and now your incentives are not like, one wants to make money, one wants to impact the world. And now you're just going to clash on every decision because you're making it differently. And my advice, if you want to find one, is heavily align on someone who has a similar working style plus similar vision of like, are you in it for the same reason? If you're both in it for a payday, great. But you should establish that you're both in it for a payday.
Yeah.
I'm working with this one startup founder in Austin. They have a co-founder, but the co-founder is like, oh, I'm not going to work for 2 months because of whatever family reason. And they're like, but I'm putting in 40 hours a week every day, more than 40. Why is the company split 50-50 if you're going AWOL for 2 months?
Yeah,
and I'm
that's fair.
And so I'm like, those are things you should talk about, expectations, how much time, everything.
Yeah.
Because you end up in conflict and now the company dissolves and whatever IP you build together is stuck in the company because theoretically, unless someone buys out the other, whatever, right? There's all these nuances, but.
Totally. Interesting.
Those are things that I don't have. I've never found a co-founder. So whenever I do my own startup, it's going to be something I'll have to figure out as well. But I would care more about having the right vibe personally.
Yeah.
Because my understanding is I can find people, vendor, service providers to do everything for me,
right,
which is sales, this, that. Like, you can do 95% of things with outsourced help.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there's a need for me to have a co-founder, but I would do it because I want to have the journey with someone. I want to have someone to bounce off ideas. I want someone to be like, hey, that's a shit idea. Mm-hmm. Like, we got to like rethink that.
Yeah.
And I would do it for that, not for, hey, you bring tech to the table or product to the table, because I fundamentally believe you can get most companies up to 1 to 5 million ARR completely with outsourced help. I don't need like a CTO to help do my tech stack.
Yeah.
Not everyone agrees with that. So
no, totally. I think one of the most difficult things that I deal with is I'm bouncing ideas off myself all day. That's the hardest thing.
Yeah.
I have no one to validate me or say that's an awful idea. You just kind of wing it. So
yeah,
I get that.
Have you thought about getting advisors and mentors in the space or related spaces, or if you don't already have them? Or
Yes. I have people that are acting in mentorship/advisor capacity to me right now. And they're just relationships that I've had for a while. But yes, I do want, you know, true on my pitch deck.
Yeah.
Advisory board, you know, that kind of thing. So
would apparel be considered a CPG brand, or?
That's a great question.
Someone said that anything in Target is considered a CPG brand.
See, I wouldn't think it would be, but I don't know.
The reason I say is there's a pretty big CPG space in Austin.
Yeah.
They have a lot of meetups, and that might be a good place to start to meet folks who are building CPG brands. I've met a bunch of people doing chocolates, alcohol, jerky,
yeah,
some form of cookie butter. Like, you get all sorts of people. And it's a pretty good community. So I'll send those to you if you haven't been to those. Yeah. Apparently the CPG space in Austin is pretty big.
No, I did not.
That's why I asked. I don't know if apparel is considered CPG, but I've met some people there building apparel brands. Yeah. So why not? And there's a bunch of people who've been in the space for 20, 30 years who just come to help, and they've spun off agencies. So they're like sort of doing client interaction as well as that. But I'll send those to you. Decent space and a bunch of those people here. And there's a big CPG thing that happens during South By as well.
That's really good to know.
I'll send you all those.
Okay, cool. Very good.
Sweet. Last question, which is more, what's next for Aya Golf? What's next in your journey? And what's one challenge you have that someone listening can potentially help you with? I don't know.
What's next is I really want to be able to articulate the digital side of my business to the public and really launch that fully. So that has taken some time for me to figure out. I've, of course, made mistakes in that area. I launched an NFT project last year, which I'm now pivoting a little bit more this year. So I want to be able to fully launch it with confidence by the end of this year and to have a plan of how I can, frankly, monetize it, but also how it meshes within this Aya Golf ecosystem that I'm building.
Yeah.
Because I'm not just trying to sell clothes. Like, I'm trying to really empower women in the space to feel good about themselves when they're on the golf course, because the golf clothes we have now are awful. So even that little thing would help. And there's a tech side of that can make it a little edgy too and fun. What could help is I would love to have guidance on that side of things, specifically when it comes to NFCs. So the chip programs and things like that. And hear how people who have had chips and things like that within their own products, what are the struggles they've faced with not only building the product, but also adoption. I'm finding it difficult that, you know, when I'm, especially places like PGA Show, when I'm talking about scanning a chip and getting a digital twin, and that goes, you're now part of the Aya ecosystem, like most people's eyes glazed over. And I want to be able to say it in layman's terms and really make people excited about it. So I would love to hear someone else's experience in that space.
Pretty cool. Random idea that just came to mind.
Tell me.
You've heard of Strava, the running app?
Yes.
So I was thinking, if I have a digital twin and I play golf, then can my NFT twin compete with other NFT twins based off my activity and like some kind of gamification ecosystem there?
Love that.
Because you can share that, you can share results. Like the whole reason Strava works is like, people running, like you have, this guy I met in Nike, in SF the other day, had 24,000 miles run on his Nike run app.
That's
like one of the top 10 in SF. And I was like, well, that's a lot of running. But like the whole fact that he's cognizant about tracking it on Nike Run app, like adds to the whole ecosystem. There's some competitive, not competitive, like you can look at what other people are doing.
Yeah.
Just random idea that came to mind when you said digital twin.
No, that's because
you're like in the athletic space. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's the gamification part of it that I want to tap into more. It's just a little bit of how I'm doing
For sure.
A lot of research on online gaming and stuff like that, just to see what people are doing. So yeah, that's a great idea. I love that.
Where can people find you? What can we link? Where can people reach out if they want to reach out?
You can find my website at ayagolf.com. That's AIEAgolf.com. You can find me on LinkedIn at Daniela Rosa, and Daniela@ayagolf.com is how you reach out to me on email.
But we'll link everything and hopefully people love the brand and show support.
I hope so too.
Thank you
so much.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for tuning into Funds and Founders. If you're a local Austin founder, a venture capitalist, or just someone who's building and in the middle of their journey and would like to be featured on an upcoming episode, submit your guest pitch to abhinavsinha.podcast@gmail.com. If you have a founder-specific event you'd like to promote on the podcast, you can also reach out to me. If you want to continue to get support through your founder journey, hit the follow button and I'll see you in the next episode.